Okay, so here we are, coming live on Liminal Radio with zero listeners, which is exactly the way I want it, kind of. And what would be the difference if I had a million listeners now as compared to zero? I'm still doing it. I probably wouldn't be eating this apple. Theory of public mind. I don't even know if people are listening or not listening. Just because it says zero doesn't mean nobody's listening. Could be a glitch. And same goes the same the other way. I just don't know. Not really. I believe. I choose to believe. And then I act accordingly. But even that action itself is accordingly obscure. Why does it make a difference when there's many listening, or few, or none? That may seem like a stupid question. In a certain sense, somebody who talks to themselves is considered diagnosably disturbed, whereas somebody who doesn't talk when some people are expecting to be talked to is likewise considered odd. The reason to speak is to communicate. But even so, that doesn't account for the whole spectrum of the experience. Like, I'm feeling self-conscious now, even though I know nobody's listening, or believe I know. Just recording, which I am, makes me self-conscious. The theory of the future public mind. Last week's Liminal Radio did not meet with my satisfaction, either during or after. When I listened back, I felt that it was not up to scratch. And made me wonder why I do it. What motivates me? And the answer seems to have to do with audience again. Whether something's being drawn out of me or not. I was thinking about being on Joe Rogan this morning, again, having forgotten about it for a while. Came back into my awareness. I think partly as a result of a night's dreaming in which I was aware of certain insights that I couldn't formulate as thoughts around the UFO. It was something to do with the people who were disseminating the UFO myth, having to apologize for it. And some kind of brilliant insight that I felt I had. But not one that I could think about, much less relay. When I woke up several times during the night, woke up this awareness that if I could articulate this, it would be a groundbreaking insight. And I think that that led me to think about being on Joe Rogan, because that's one of the things I would talk to Joe Rogan about, is what's going on with the UFO thing. And then I thought about recently the contrast between me doing this and me being on Joe Rogan. Like, why would I think that I could be live on Joe Rogan with millions of listeners when I have a hard time talking in the comfort of my own space without pressure for liminal radio? But the answer is that the pressure is what brings out the inspiration, even if it's just the pressure of having somebody asking questions. That's encouraging pressure. There can be discouraging pressure if it's overwhelming. But just being in a dialogue makes all the difference in the world. And then who one is within a dialogue with, and what their level of interest and awareness is, and so on. If I were talking to Joe Rogan, there'd be a combination of his own interest, which he would presumably have if he'd invited me on, with the shared interest and attention of his audience. He's like a focal point for his audience, which is hundreds of thousands of people. So potentially that would bring something out of me. It could also bring something out of me that was false, forced and inauthentic, just as I felt was brought out of me last week, only having 6 listeners, which was less than usual, and I don't think it related to the number of listeners there. I think it related only to the state I was in emotionally and psychologically, and my inability to talk about it, as in it wasn't something I could talk about ethically. And so, because I didn't feel I could address or air the things that were impinging on my awareness emotionally and otherwise, probably there was some kind of coping mechanism, displacement activity going on with my manner of delivery. I just saw that Paul Steer is listening. Hello, Paul. So you're the only listener. It's just you and me. And, well, I don't know what to say about that. I guess if you want to type questions in, then I'll certainly respond to that. Otherwise, I'm essentially just testing something out, recording this, imagining if I was doing it for a recording. Obviously, there's no pressure at all there as far as dead air and things like that. There's still a certain degree of pressure, because if I'm just saying something I know isn't worth recording, then I start to feel silly. And flip side being is that I feel pressure to say something that is worth recording. So that's the very beginning, the thin end of the wedge that grows thicker and thicker the more aware of an audience I am, and the pressure to say something meaningful. Although, as I was just saying, that can be compensated for by a kind of positive pressure, which is the interest of the audience. There's a, might say, psychic or anyway a mysterious element of responding to need, like the need of the listener or the person I'm speaking with or to. I think I can pick it up, tune into it, and respond to it. And I think there is something unknown about human beings and in nature in general, that we are configured in such a way, because we're part of a collective organism and meta-organism that transcends biology even, if we are, then there's something in our configuration or our natural makeup that is aware of the needs of others when we interact with them, when we come into contact with them, and if we're sufficiently aware or tuned into our subtler awareness, it's not quite the same thing because it might not be a conscious awareness, then we're going to instinctively or intuitively respond to the needs of others. And I suppose that would have to start with or include, start and end with, our own unconscious needs for ourselves. So when we're speaking to somebody, there's a bit of music coming there, that's not intentional. If we're tuning into the moment and their needs in the moment, then what we deliver, what we transmit, is going to be something that's meaningful to us, even independently of the meaning it has for that other person, insofar as we might get something different from it. It wouldn't be independent entirely, because that's the point. We'd be answering a need of another, which also mirrors a need within ourselves. But mirrors do, they're not necessarily at 180 degrees reflecting directly. There may be different angles of approach. You know, that's a bit abstract, isn't it? And I suppose that this instinctive, intuitive responsibility within all of us that I hope to develop by talking publicly and even privately recording and then sharing, which then becomes public, which is kind of makes it spread out over time, because I would have to be somehow tuning into the future needs of an audience or of a listener, even though while I was speaking they wouldn't be present. But anyway, this whole process that I've been engaged in since I was a child, because I recorded myself even as a child, if it's to help me develop and deepen my awareness of the interconnectivity between myself and others, and therefore my responsibility, my ability to respond to the needs of others intuitively and instinctively by articulation, by self-expression, true self-expression, not ego self-expression, all of this is going to be compromised by the degree to which I have a specific goal besides that. And yet that first goal, that primary goal, even if it becomes conscious as I'm making it conscious now, is entirely general. It doesn't give me any specific idea about what to talk about. That's the point of it. So that presents a problem for the mind, because normally, and this is what I did last week, normally if I'm going to speak about something, I want an idea of what I'm going to speak about, which would include an idea of why I'm going to speak about it, which would itself be embedded in motivation, self-interest, such as wanting to talk to Joe Rogan, do a show reel that would persuade Joe Rogan to have me on his show about UFOs, the history of trauma, these amazing insights that I've had, somehow condensed into a persuasive presentation that would give Joe an inkling of what he could expect, what he could hope to draw out of me if he had me on the show, let's say. And then what being on the show, I could present this amazing new model of understanding about the UFO and trauma and human history even to hundreds of thousands of people. And from that, I could generate lots of interest, what is known as success in this world, financial and or otherwise. Now, all those things are perfectly valid as far as even that primary goal of reaching more people and being able to assist more people, but they're not necessarily necessary to it. They could be entirely superfluous, actually, so say perfectly valid. Theoretically, they are. It's easy to rationalize those things as, oh, well, that's all part of my primary goal, which is to develop responsibility, to act responsibly, to gain more power, thereby more responsibility, thereby more power, and so on. Using power in a neutral sense, because it has, of course, quite a negative correlation today. Hoy en día, as they say in Spanish, which is today, on the day, nowadays. I was just thinking in Spanish there, because I just did a long 3-hour conversation in Spanish with Alejandro to follow up our English conversation, which was the latest Liminalist. And it was very difficult to do it in Spanish. It forced me to think in different ways, or at least speak, obviously speak in different ways, but I mean the connection between my thinking and my speaking was compromised or altered by that. I suppose I had to think in English, translate into Spanish, and then speak in Spanish or something like that. I'm not sure, because it was happening very fast, of course, but certainly I was just more aware of the physical difficulty of speaking. So, Martin has joined us. That means there's two listeners. Let me just see if there's any questions. Okay, so I've been talking to myself for the last 20 minutes. Because I didn't put the microphone up. Thank you. Well, apologies to those listeners, I have an echo, so I have to put headphones on, who were listening to silence for 20 minutes. You can hear the 20 minutes that I was talking to a dead microphone in the recording later on. It sort of illustrates what I was talking about, which was talking without an audience, and why I was talking, and so on and so forth. Okay, so, and now suddenly there's three listeners, well, not suddenly, but a third listener has arrived. Right, so obviously ignore all that came before. I have to, because there are three people listening who didn't hear any of that, which means I can't organically follow on from any of that, which means I feel sort of stuck. I don't want to repeat it, though. Though I'm tempted to, a little bit, to sum it up. The essence of it was to do with speaking as a intuitive and spontaneous response to the requirements of the listener, as compared to speaking with a particular agenda or purpose in mind, the operative word being mind there, because the speaking that is responsible, that is able, that is a response to an intuitive sense of the needs of the other, by definition, well, there's a spectrum there, because of course the other might actually ask a question or request advice, and then the mind can get involved, more involved. But in this particular situation, and in many, I would say, in life, even when the person is right in front of us, we don't know what it is they need, even if they ask something specifically. They may very well be unaware of what they're asking for, what they really need, and their question or their request may actually be a way to disguise what they're really feeling. And so if we respond directly to that, then we won't actually be giving the person what they need, and therefore we won't be giving ourselves what we need. We won't be falling into the flow or tuning into the deeper, subtler awareness of this connection, this living connection between all of us, that is constantly tugging on our heartstrings, our soul strings, to play a tune that will satisfy the moment, or will be fully appropriate to the moment, will allow whatever's unresolved in the moment to come into some form of consciousness and therefore be resolved. This is about resolving things. I don't think we can even speculate about what we would talk about, if anything, if there were nothing to resolve. People, of course, do talk all the time about stuff that has nothing to do with their problems or their worries or their pain or their trauma. They'll talk about Game of Thrones or football or Caitlyn Jenner's gender. But they will be doing so, possibly anyway, most likely. The last one does have more potential for exploring deep traumas. They all do, of course. People found Game of Thrones traumatic. They could talk about that. But generally, anyway, my point here is that we do talk about things simply as a way to be together and to share time together, and to reassure each other and to start to feel safe and so on. So that can lead to, that itself is seeking a kind of resolution, the resolution of anxiety being in the presence of other people, and that potentially can lead to a feeling of being safer and therefore going into real areas that are seeking some kind of resolution. But I think it's safe to say that a large proportion, probably 90 plus percent of human communication is a kind of dissembling, distraction, deflecting, to avoid intimate contact, not just with the other, but with our own pain and with our own trauma. And the two, of course, are intimately connected, because we can only connect to others insofar as we can connect to ourselves or be connected within ourselves. We can only connect to somebody in a heartfelt way if we're in tune with our hearts, let's say, to start there, or in an embodied way if we're fully embodied. And we can only do that if we are willing, ready and able to tune into the pain and distress and the unresolved trauma in our bodies and our hearts and our psyches. Now that might seem oversimplified, but so be it. The reason I summed that up was because of trying to sum up the previous reason or thrust of talking before I realized that nobody could hear me, being a response to unresolved areas in our lives. The other thing that I'll reiterate is that I wasn't satisfied with last week's broadcast, so that's why I've been very ambivalent about doing it this week. And I figured I would not tell anyone, not tweet it, and that I would just show up and do it for myself, do a recording and not really pay too much attention to if anyone was there. But of course I have to check, because there might be comments or questions. But and the reason I think I was not satisfied with last week was there was too much of that mind-based imposition of content that prevented me from simply being in tune with the moment. And as I also said previously, I feel I have to repeat now out of respect and consideration for the two listeners. The primary reason that I'm aware of for doing these speaking experiments is to develop a deeper awareness of my own responsibility, to increase my responsibility, my ability to respond, which involves deepening my awareness of what's there to respond to. Now that starts with my own body. I'm finding words in my body, so to speak, as in I'm locating energies, areas of energetic interest, perhaps blockage, perhaps flow, perhaps warmth, perhaps cold, perhaps tension, perhaps release of tension, whatever they are. I can't say, because it's not a mental process, that's my point, but I'm using my awareness, directing my awareness, who knows with what, that's a big question mark in itself. It's like awareness is directing itself to the body in order to know what to say, in order to find something to say. And but that's not really about having something to say. It's like massaging the body internally with awareness, and the speaking is the grunts and groans of the body as it responds to the massage. Or perhaps it's like the farts and belches, not sure, this is all quite new. And I would say intuitively that this is the way that we, or that I at least am able to respond to other people's needs in the moment, to say what it is they most need to hear, that's going to be most useful, and that's going to correspond with their own present situation, is by tuning into my body. Because although, as I was talking about when the microphone was turned down, if I'm speaking and I'm just recording, that's a very different sort of pressure or context of the listener, because I don't even know if anyone will listen. And I, as far as I'm aware, I'm the only one who can hear this right now, which was actually how it was when I was recording it, thinking that there was one person listening, Paul, and in fact, nobody was listening. So it was an interesting kind of experiment there that I did on myself, because I was talking differently when I thought Paul was listening. Turned out he wasn't. Anyway, my point here is that even though the way that I respond or express whatever's going on in my body is presumably different depending on whether I'm in the presence of someone or not, it's not that different. So anyway, I kind of lost the thread there because I got too complicated, got too convoluted in my mind. The point I was trying to arrive at, without losing touch with my body and whatever it's saying, was that, as far as I can intuit, the way to be aware of what the listener most needs to hear in this moment is by tuning into my body, because my body is being affected by your bodies, even though we're not in the same meat space, as it's known. We are on the same planet, so we are connected. And somehow the internet allows for, because it allows for a technological connection, even though it's via simulation. This voice you're hearing is not my voice, it's a computer-generated simulation of it, or it's a recreation of it, and I can't even hear you. The awareness or the belief that you're listening anyway causes me to tune in, or allows me to tune in, and there's some sort of long-distance transference between our bodies, presumably because they're already interconnected as part of the earth. And when we connect via the technology and I'm talking and you're listening, then that connection, even though it's a connection that extends to every individual on the planet, the connection between me and you specifically gets lit up in our bodies. So I'm going to feel in my body, I'm going to feel or experience certain changes in the temperature, changes in the heart rate, changes in the breathing, changes in the pressure, changes, did I already say temperature? Anyway, those kinds of changes, too subtle for my mind to notice, but not so subtle that they won't influence my words if I keep my awareness on the body. Remarkably. Now, I'm finding this way of speaking unusual, I'd say, and not exactly tiring. I wouldn't say it was tiring. I'd say it was more tiring last week when I was staying in my mind, because there was the feeling of having to pretend, having to believe in the words that my mind were giving me to make them persuasive or make them feel authentic. That's a very tiring thing that we do, but we're used to doing it, so we don't necessarily notice how tiring it is. It's like if we've got our spine out of whack or whatever, when we walk in a way that actually is putting too much stress on our skeleton, and we are over time developing physical impairments, as I'm experiencing now, we don't notice that we're tiring ourselves out that way. If we were to start to adjust our posture and walk in a way that was more correct, that would be tiring for us. So it's probably something like that. I'm feeling a certain amount of pressure in my forehead, and I don't know, it's a bit like being sleepy. I suppose it's a bit like trance state, perhaps, which would make sense. I mean, there's the whole idea of channeling, which is we go into a trance and then speak, so this could be, which I'm very suspicious of, particularly as a Irish friend once told me that the rule there that he'd heard was if a channel isn't conscious of what they're saying while they're channeling, then they've been taken over, and that's not a good situation. If they can stay conscious, they're still present, then it's more reliable. So this would be more like that. But also in a certain sense reversing it, in that I'm not going in a trance to speak from a deeper place. I'm just tuning into my body so that I can speak from a somewhat deeper place, and that starts to feel a little bit trance-like. Anyway, obviously this is all very meta. As in, I'm just speaking about speaking and the possibilities or the options, the different variations of speaking. And, well, I'd say there's nothing more worth speaking about than how to speak, even though that might seem sort of circular and like, well, if that's all there is to speak about, I mean, why speak at all? But that is a valid question, and that is the question, why speak at all? Never mind why speak publicly and broadcast it. And if my intention is partially, primarily even to learn how to speak better, then it would make sense that the reason to listen to me would also be to learn how to speak better. And we can't really overestimate the power of speech in our world, as crippled and as hobbled as it has become, as compromised and co-opted, contaminated and corrupted, so that now we're all masters of illegitimate persuasion and sophistry, not really even masters, really, but it's not something that one would want to master anyway. But certainly we've developed sufficient sophistry and capacity for dissembling and whatnot, and for the use of intellect and of mind and of language to avoid the truth and persuade others that we're being true when we're not, and all of that kind of stuff, the abuse of the word and the abuse of language, I would say, is central to the situation that we're in collectively and globally. Absolutely central to it, and therefore it may be that we have to discover, develop both a bit of both, a new way of speaking in order to talk our way through and out of this. We need to articulate what has not been articulated in order to resolve these problems that we're not able to even articulate. And, oh, what was I going to say there? Articulation. I forgot. I'm aware of not putting music on because I don't want to be doing the radio thing today, but I think that was part of the thing that's one of the problems, is creating a structure. This is where liminality comes in, is that we create a structure, I create a structure in order to feel comfortable enough to improvise within, be spontaneous. But then the structure becomes a crutch or safety net, and then, well, I don't even notice if I'm limping or if I'm falling off the high wire anymore, because there's nothing at stake. I can just fall back on the structure. Of course, there is always something at stake, and what's being at stake, what is at stake, is in this case is being exposed or feeling exposed. And I think that's probably a universal, like, what is at stake, what is preventing us collectively as a species from healing and of loving and of speaking honestly and of resolving this impossible situation that we're in, which my mind doesn't even want to go to, or my voice, my speaking, I don't even want to speak about the situation, because I think in a certain sense it's illusory. But in another sense it's very not illusory, it's very, very real. So it depends where we're perceiving from, and if we were perceiving from the place that all of these, this collective predicament that we're in is illusory, then we wouldn't be in that predicament. So, and yet, I mean, that goes both ways. We wouldn't have created it in the first place, but also it would be gone if we were just to shift into that state now. Then it would be gone. It would be resolved. Not, I mean, who knows? It would probably be a global apocalypse that would be happening outside of our shift to enlightened consciousness. But I mean, still, it would be resolved in us. But that doesn't seem possible in more ways than one. Obviously, it's simply not realistic. It's not going to happen. But there are presumably reasons it's not going to happen, which is that a shift that occurs too fast in that regard is fatal, is terminal. It can't be processed. It's like psychedelic drugs. That's why they're so harmful, because people are not, they're not ready. Hardly anyone who does psychedelic drugs is ready for the kind of psychic shift that they bring about, because if they were ready, they wouldn't need the drugs in the first place. Now, of course, there's a spectrum there, so things can also arise organically, and one can be ready at any time for a journey of zero distance. So one could be ready for a psychedelic trip, and one could become enlightened without doing decades of self-work. Theoretically, it happened to St. Paul, if it's true, but then he didn't eat mushrooms. But it could have, you know, who knows, right? But what was I getting to? Yes, so because it requires some sort of preparation, psychological and somatic preparation, for the shift from the illusion to the real, from the temporal to the eternal, let's say, then what's necessary, and I've always understood this, believed it anyway, is a seeing of the predicament more clearly. We can't just go from, oh God, like a psychosocially conditioned and trauma generated illusion about the world to start raving reality in one step. There's an intermediary step, which is what I've mapped in my last three books, the Trilogy of Disillusionment. It's to uninstall the culturally implanted illusions about the world that aren't that they're not the illusions that matter is finite or insentient, or that they're not the illusion that prevents us from seeing the true nature of reality. They're the illusions that prevent us from seeing the true nature of the world, and that's very different. The world itself is a veil that's been pulled over reality, we could say. Nature itself is that, but it's a transparent veil. It does allow us to see the divine through it. The world is an opaque veil. And on top of that is the veil that we have co-created to prevent us seeing the opaque veil of the world, which is as a nightmare of history, or a veil of soul-making in the more positive poet sense, a chrysalis within which we are being putrefied. And transformed or transmuted from water into wine, or from bee shit into honey, or whatever, I suppose it's pollen into honey via the bee. But anyway, not to get tangled up with these metaphors, I was just trying to illustrate something about why articulation, responsible expression and use of language does center around resolution of seemingly unresolvable problems, or the seemingly unresolvable problem of the world. The problem isn't the world, the problem is I think, that we don't let ourselves see the nature of the world. If we were to see the nature of the world, I think we would see that as a problem it is utterly insurmountable. It is so vast and complex and ancient, a machine of deception and of oppression and exploitation, a dark satanic mill. I think that's where I was meant to go when I went to the Vale of Soulmaking. I hopped over Blake and went to Keats from the other one, whatever it was, that was negative. So the satanic mill is the in-between stage. Like, it's still poetic, but it's definitely dark. The satanic mill is also a veil of soul making, but in order to see that, we have to see the configuration of the mill that we're in, that it is satanic in the sense that it's a shadow image of nature. It's a traumatic response to nature, a coping mechanism. Which started as reasonably benign, with the discovery of fire or the invention of the wheel. Language itself seemed perfectly benign to begin with. I mean, fire is neutral, language potentially is neutral, the wheel is neutral. So it's all still neutral in a certain sense. But it's not neutral because it's being created and applied by a leviathan, a corporate leviathan, Cthulhu of world government and religion, which is our own collective unconscious, which weirdly has been co-opted by our own shadow. So it really seems there's an artificial element in here that's infiltrated the system. It very much seems as though that's the case. But I think we'll see that the artificial element is one that we've created. We've actually generated, or I don't think what the correct word is. It's also like an internal stigmata, like cancer, or like a blood clot. The body itself has somehow generated this implant out of its own material until it has all the appearances of a foreign installation. I suspect that's the case, because if it were truly a foreign installation, we would just be stuck in an us and them polarity, where we have to get rid of the flyer minds, or the sociopathic elite, or the reptilian hordes, or whatever else it is, in order to be free. We have to push it out and somehow create a barrier that it can't ever cross. But that would then prevent integration. We couldn't be integrated with the whole if our harmony depended on the quarantining of some aspect that had destroyed our harmony. Harmony has to be wholeness, otherwise it's always going to be a limited and temporary harmony. Okay, it's been a few comments from Paul. Besides exploiting the land and the natural world for monetary gain, the main challenge for Canada and all of the people who live here is to establish and maintain channels of authentic communication. The Quakers might opt first for silence until moved by the spirit to speak, n'est-ce pas? Yes, it's certainly not a new idea. Nor is it a particularly uncommon idea. However, I think there's definitely room for exploring, hopefully potentially without mentalizing, the ways in which we can be moved and why we're being moved. The spirit's rather generic catch-all phrase, and although I do believe it does come down to that, ultimately, the gospel advice of think not what you will say on that day, for the spirit will provide the words. That was to do with having to testify in court, defend themselves in court during the persecution, I think. So yeah, that would be a moment in which what one said would really count for a lot. And because of that, the possibility that fight or flight would take over, and one wouldn't be able to respond spontaneously is quite strong. But I have found that for myself, like, I do seem to perform quite well or better under pressure. Not always, depends what kind of pressure. This is back to what I was talking about initially. When the mic was turned down, I won't go back to that. My grandfather is a Quaker and my uncle is a Quaker still. How about some poetry, elevated language? I don't know if you're asking for that or just suggesting it as a alternative. I mean, clearly that this is what poetry is when it's good, is a more substantial kind of articulation. So it's a combination of rhythm and meaning. And I don't know, but I would have to suppose that the more that we speak from the body, which is from the heart and the soul, the more information, if you like. I don't really like this word information much anymore because it's become so overused, and I think we've got stuck in this idea that everything's informational. But more meaningful, the more meaningful the rhythm of speaking would become, the tone of voice, the pauses between the words, the emphasis, the melody of the words, and so on. It might not actually sound more like song, but I think it would communicate more and more on the level of song, which of course poetry is a step away from song. Speech as music, musical speech. But I think it has to, like everything of worth, it has to come from the inside out and be organic, so that there might be poetic quality to a deeper articulation, but to try and speak poetically, thinking that that would thereby make it deeper, of course, is not going to work. Actually, St. Paul would have eaten most anything edible growing beside the road to Tarsus. Well, there's a theory waiting to be formulated that he just grabbed a bunch of datura and didn't even realize it. The idea of trusting the spirit when anxious about knowing what to speak when stressed or challenged is also very Zen, I think. Poetry is language filled with imagery and symbol, which is actually highly conscious. Well, that is something about poetry that it tends to lean towards the visual, and I have found that to articulate, to explain, to describe things, even or perhaps especially things that are quite abstract, psychological or sociological, using imagery, metaphor is the most effective way. And it follows really from what we know, that we relate, we interact with, or we perceive the world imagistically, sensorially anyway, it's not just images of course, sounds and smells and everything, before we experience it linguistically. And this would be, this is true individually as it's true collectively, unless we think that the human species was somehow created with language. I think that's what the Tower of Babel is about, the loss of original language. So it's not about what we're communicating, it's how we're communicating, what we're where we're communicating from. I think we all experience this. There are moments when we're communicating, sharing with somebody, interacting with somebody, where we feel connected to them, deeply connected. And then there are other moments where we don't feel it at all. And it can be quite mysterious, like what facilitates that feeling of connection, of true affinity. And we may not actually notice truly what's caused it. Because I would say that affinity, the deeper affinity relates to our bodies getting synchronized, so that we're able to intuitively and instinctively respond to the other in the moment. We're being synchronized. And when we synchronize our bodies and our hearts with the other, then that amplifies the signal within our own hearts and bodies of their existence, their expression, their unique autonomous orientation, whatever it is that we have to give, transmit, gets amplified if we synchronize with another. And that can develop exponentially. Like the deeper a sense we have of ourselves by connecting to others, the deeper a sense we have of the other. And those connections can extend. So something's being passed on like a current. But it's very, very difficult to consciously seek this out, I think, or try and contrive it. And I've found a situation where I can do that. I'm headed there again very soon to Finland. So when I go to Finland, there's a bunch of people that I don't have much contact with outside of those retreats in Finland with Dave Ashana. And it's kind of inconvenient to go there, but I keep going there because I know that every time I go there, I enter into an experience that I don't have anywhere else, and it's an experience of community. Now, I could say it's sort of artificial because it's a retreat. People who pay money to be in the same place together under the guidance of one person and so on. That's why it works. It creates a space that's disconnected from my ordinary life. And so all my habits and routines get suspended. And I'm in a space where everybody is there for the same reason, kind of. There are definitely a lot of variations there, and if everybody described their reason, they'd all sound very, very different. But essentially, they're there to discover themselves. So in the most kind of generic fashion, and to find more peace in their lives and get grounded in truth and reality, let's say. I mean, as soon as you start to talk about it, it becomes rather naff, potentially. Which is why I wanted to just focus on the community. Now, it wouldn't work with just anyone, but it's not necessarily about shared interests so much as shared orientation. And I don't think the orientation can be summed up in words or encapsulated in words. I don't feel comfortable articulating it. And partly that's because it's been over-articulated. It's been poorly described countless times. Very rarely has it been accurately represented, which is sort of the point. I mean, it's sort of inseparable from the point. Because each of us would have our orientation towards the true and the real, and towards alignment with our own souls and our secret lives, let's say. They're secret to us. They're not secret per se. It's not a world of espionage or intrigue. It's just that we've compartmentalized our awareness in the mind, and so we can't distribute it through the body, and therefore we can't experience existence 100% through the body, which means we're not aware of the soul, the life of the soul, because the life of the soul is experienced through the cells of the body. Not just the cells, but through the totality of the body, or so I have come to believe. And what was I saying? Oh, our orientation. So that orientation isn't an orientation of the mind. It is the orientation of all living creatures, I think. So then it's more about those of us who become sufficiently in tune with our natures to start orientating ourselves by them. And we might make a whole bunch of mistakes mentally, cognitively, in terms of what our orientation is and what we need to do to strengthen it and deepen it and to serve it, to maintain it or pursue it. As was in my case, I feel I had this orientation from a young age, not counting childhood, because all children would have it, I think, from like 21 or something on, when I recognised the fundamental misery of a worldly existence. I couldn't not recognise it because I was experiencing it, and that let me know that I had a deeper orientation that was away from the world, that saw the world as something to get free of, not in a Gnostic sense, I don't think, although it would be hard to say what the difference is. Perhaps it isn't the world, but the mind, the configuration of the mind. But the world has become such an externalized replica of that configuration that they're practically synonymous at this point. In any case, that's what Whitley Strieber says all the time. Don't want to develop that tick. Articulating that orientation in such a way that others who are oriented in a similar way will hear it and respond to it and have their own sense of it deepened, and that a connection can be established so that we're in this shared orientation, which of course now there are lemmings, which is not good, although I don't think lemmings do really run off a cliff, and there are termites and things, and there are things that we probably don't want to aspire to as human beings, but in terms of like a collective movement. And I don't know if this ever would become a collective movement in a visible sense. Although me going to Finland is that, as only 15 people or something. I think it would be more likely it would be distributed around the collective, and so it wouldn't necessarily be visible, but it would be happening anyway. So it would be a kind of unevenly distributed murmuration of soul-oriented bodies awakening to their natures and connecting to others who are also awakening to their natures, and thereby increasing the awakening. But this isn't what's been described in the New Age circles. That's some sort of counterfeit, for sure. I think that the problem that we have with it is that the mind, the revolution can't be televised, that the mind can't actually be included in this awakening, this collective prison break, because it would snitch. It would go to the man, and it would nip the awakening in the bud if it could. So I think, in my experience anyway, it's occurring at a very mundane level, and I keep my mind occupied by focusing on the problems that need resolving but that are irresolvable, unresolvable. I guess to slowly over time convince the mind that it's not required as an active participant in the project of awakening. It can release its hold over awareness. That's all it can do. And I think it can only be persuaded of that by being confronted time and time again with its own impotence and incapacity to really grasp any situation. So I guess this brings me full circle to language and why I thought I might stop doing this radio show, because, or if, like last week, I'm just bringing my mind to it, then I don't know what the reason for doing it would be. If it's just a way to keep flexing the muscles of my mind and making my mind feel like it's doing something useful, that's not useful to me. So I have to be aware of that and be careful of it. And this also coincides with me going away for a couple of weeks, so then I'd be taking a break anyway. So I guess we'll just see what happens in Finland and where I'm at the end of that.